Chapter 24. The Bakers at Eclo. We were placed in adjoining cells, but could not see each other. Everything was timber, floor, ceiling, and walls, and the door had its middle cut out and replaced with iron bars. The bars were as thick around as two of my fingers, and I figured even Risa wouldn't be able to do very much with them. On our first day, I slapped all along the walls to get a sense of the place, and every one of them felt as thick and solid as the stone of Erda's mountains. We were fucked, it seemed. Well and truly. They said nothing further than when we'd first been arrested. Sometimes a jailer would come around with a bowl of slop, every other day, it seemed. And at first I tried asking him why we were held and what would be done to us. As an answer, he threw the bowl at me. The slop went all over the floor, gummy wads of porridge and tough, stringy meat. And it was 4 days between meals then, instead of two. I cursed him when he threw the bowl, after he left, of course, and swore my dignity would remain intact. On the following day, my hunger was such that I tried to lick what was left from the floor, though it had gone rancid. I was sick over the grate in the corner. The next time a bowl was offered to me, I took it quietly and licked it clean. It was probably still rancid when it was in the bowl, but it didn't make me sick. It was one of the better meals I've had, in fact. Risa had it much worse. He'd always eaten 4 times as much as me, and I can eat quite a lot after a long day. But he only got as much as they gave me. You could hear his stomach through the wall most nights, and sometimes I could hear him crying from the hunger. I would speak to him on these occasions, trying to calm him. As any street child knows, even crying takes energy, makes the hunger that much worse. You learn to just lay there and accept it. Pretty soon, you stop feeling so hungry. You feel dizzy all the time and must lay down often, but the pain will eventually leave once you've suffered enough. The problem was that they always brought us another bowl just as the pain began to leave. We ate what they gave us, of course. Whatever they gave us, we had to. Refusing the food would have made us weaker. It would have gone over to eventual sickness and then death. But eating that bowl every other day awakened your stomach again, just as it was getting used to being empty, and it would resume turning and growling within you. It got so loud and so wild sometimes that we were nauseous and began to dread the arrival of food as much as we hoped for it. And I think that must have been the point. The cell was, in fact, not so very different from my old shack further north. If I stood with my back against one wall, 3 regular steps brought me into contact with the other side. Straw was scattered across the floorboards for our bedding, which you learned to pile into a corner pretty soon. If you did, there was nearly enough to cushion you from the hard floor at night. Then, too, I think piling it up like that might have helped to squish many of the lice and bedbugs when I laid upon it. I told myself this anyway, hoping it was true. It probably wasn't. My scalp and crotch seemed to be crawling with the fuckers on my first day there. It was good to push the straw into a single corner for other reasons as well. They gave us no pot or bucket for elimination. There was an iron grate at one corner of the floor. You had to balance over it to do your necessary. Some of what you produced, some of that would go through the grate, but much of it would not. If you wanted to be rid of it, you had to use your drinking ration to wash it away. But we were given very little to drink, and so our cells smelled always of shit. There were no windows. The only light we had came from sconces in the outer hall. Sometimes the sconces would wink out, and that was good. I enjoyed the pure dark very much when I could get it. Then I could see images. Images I didn't have to work to maintain. They came on their own, taking many forms, and I could often watch them for a very long time. I am not sure how long, minutes or hours. It all felt the same in the cells. Many images and the sounds to match, all doing whatever they desired in the darkness. I once saw a long line of shovels, all alive and marching, toward me like an infantry battalion. But I was undisturbed. I felt as though it was right for them to seek me out, as if we belonged together. and I watched them come with curiosity. I watched as they surrounded me and encircled me, marching and marching, until someone lit the candles in the hall. Whatever thing I saw always disappeared when someone lit the candles in the hall. Another time I remember being outside of Erda, watching as she flew by. There was Godin, sitting atop her back, and I called to him. He looked at me, and I saw he had only one eye. The other was a bottomless socket. He shook his head as if he were sad, and flew on. Something small and black fluttered all around Godin and Erda. It looked to me like a large moth, but they were very far away, and it darted very quickly around the old god's head. Maybe it was something else. Sometimes I saw Mathis and I side by side, he hammering at the anvil while I stood by the bellows, ready to drive the air through the coals. It was strange to stand outside of myself like that. Strange to watch me doing normal things with that man. I would have thought it should enrage me, or that I would scream at myself to get away, to go anywhere far away, to leave the others behind and just go. I did not. I only watched in curiosity. Everything I saw in that cell, I saw with curiosity. Even when he put the hammer aside, gestured at the door to the home with his crooked finger, and told me to go clean myself. Even then, I was only curious. Of course, I never yelled at myself to leave the others behind, even when it was truly happening. There is not much in my life that I'm proud of. But one of the things that does bring me pride, true pride, is that I never left the others behind. Some of them died on the cobbles after, but we all got out together. All together. One night I saw Ing, as if she'd walked right into my cell without any of the guards noticing. She sat by me, took up one of my hands, and began to rub it between her own. Then I cried, as Risa had cried, because her hands felt the way they did.
"Poor, poor Udo," she said. "You've lost your way again, haven't you?"
"I never had a way," I mumbled. It was very hard to talk. My tongue was thick and felt of leather.
"You did. Once. I tried to give you a new way, but it seems not to have taken hold."
"I don't understand."
"I know. It is all right that you don't understand. Understanding is seldom required."
"Tell me what you wish and I'll do it."
"You already are, Udo."
"No. We're locked up. I got your son locked up."
"You mean Risa?"
I cleared my throat and looked away.
"Don't be embarrassed. It is a good name. I love his name. You mustn't feel so."
"I'm sorry."
"Don't be."
"I'm sorry. I'm so, so sorry." She sighed. And things were funny after that. I felt better suddenly. My tongue didn't feel as thick, and my bones stopped aching so much. Later on, she spoke again, but I couldn't tell if she had been there with me the whole time or if she had come to me a second time. I had no idea if I'd been asleep or awake. Had no idea, in fact, if I was currently asleep or awake.
"You've started wearing gloves."
"Yes," I said. I felt much better, more calm.
"It's lucky they let you keep them."
"They just tossed us in here. They wouldn't say why."
"The why isn't important. You'll be released soon."
Oh, great mother. Are you really here right now?"
"I don't know, Udo. Am I really here right now?"
I heard laughter in her voice. "I sure hope so," I said. Then she really did laugh, beautifully. So I asked, "Are you going to cause us to be released somehow?"
"Not I."
Her voice smiled.
"But you will soon not be in this cell."
"They're going to kill me then."
"Would you rather stay in here?"
"Yes. No. I don't know. I don't care. Only I don't want them to do Risa the same."
"Risa?
He doesn't deserve any of this. He doesn't even know why he's in here. It's my fault that he's here." She was quiet for a very long time. So long I feared she'd left again. I could still feel her hands around mine, though, so I did not worry much. Finally, she said,
"They'll bring you more food soon."
"I don't want it."
"Oh, no?"
"No. I can see only the blackness of the cell after I've eaten. I won't be able to talk to you. Not for a while." She laughed again and said,
"That is probably so. Nevertheless, you must eat."
"I will if you do something for me."
"Setting conditions?"
I felt her pinch my wrist. It seemed playful. It didn't hurt at all. "I ask only that you visit your son in the next cell. I'm beginning to worry. For a while I could talk to him and he'd answer in his own way, but he hasn't answered me for a long time now."
"He's very sad,"
she agreed.
"But I cannot do what you ask."
"Why? Please don't be angry with me. But why?"
"I can't explain in a way you would understand. He can't see me the way you can right now. He's not ready."
"He must be hungrier. I thought it must have something to do with that." Her hand squeezed mine and I felt full of pride. "Go see him, will you? In his cell, when he's hungry enough. I know how happy it would make him."
"I won't get the chance, Udo. They're coming for you now."
"What? Who?" She started to fade. I don't know how I knew. It was still pitch dark in there, but I could feel her leaving me. I heard the long echo of footsteps approaching, and suddenly I could see a flicker of light in my chamber. For a moment I thought I saw the outline of her form beside me on the floor, tender and exquisite. Then she was gone, vanished faster than a dream. The first time I saw the courtyard was the morning they pulled us from our cells. We'd been installed to the cells by another route, see? And it was evening when they'd locked us in. We were brought out in a morning. It was very bright, I remember, as Sunna was in full glory to the south. The shadow of the outer wall was sharp and crisp along the ground. I spent much time looking at the ground. You have to when they pull you from the cells. The light is so powerful it hurts you to look at anything for very long, so you look down at your feet. The cobbles in the courtyard were all this regular reddish brown, as if they'd been fired from river clay. The lower facade making up the base of the keep's donjon, the stables, the lord's smithy, everything was wrapped in that river clay. Not counting the bricks under my feet, it had all been sculpted in place by a mason to appear as though it was fitted stone. I didn't understand this at the time, though I've since learned why they built it that way. To my knowledge, which is today absolute, there is but one structure in all of Teodiscus made completely from stone. This is the royal castle at Komar, built from stones quarried at Erda's North Range that were later floated down the river on barges, floated all the way south to the coastal city, sometimes offloaded at the bank and hauled over land when the river was too treacherous, but always returned to new barges to be floated eventually into the city. The legend we all told each other was that the first king who lived there, the one who had the place built, in other words, made a deal with Ing that would allow him to take the stones from the ground without retribution. His end of the bargain was that the resulting fortress would be built in Ing's honor, which is why the fortress in Komar has always been called Ing's Fortress. Being who I am, I know that this is also untrue, though I've not bothered to tell anyone. I think the true point behind the fortress being made from stone was to show how powerful the founding king was. It was the idea that he could send his craftsmen north with an army of diggers to harvest the bones right under Ing's nose, and nothing would happen to any of them. They must have all been terrified, going up there to carve away at the mountainside so blatantly. I suppose they anticipated their own killing with each swing of the pick. A few of the stories say that some of them really did die up there. But each incident sounds to me like they died accidentally, from rock slides and the like. I'll wager it was confusing, though, for those diggers. To go at that mountain for as long as they had to get a whole fortress built and not be stopped by the Dwergas? They must have come out of that job asking many questions. questions about their place in the world and the nature of digging, and how all of the horrible things that were supposed to happen to them hadn't. I imagined it was this, most likely. Their questions. I imagine it was their new questions that caused the king to have them all executed when the digging was finished. Ing's fortress continues to stand to this day, built for a king's ego over the bones of a murdered laborer army. It serves as a potent reminder that a king is powerful enough to sometimes ignore the gods' laws. And then, in a city like Goslar, the lords mimic the greatness of Ing's fortress by paying masons to slap clay onto timbered walls and work it with their knives until it resembles true fitted stone. The effect is ruined, though, when you see the wooden structures sprouting from the top. The wood is visible so that you can see the structure is still obviously made from timber, all to appease Ing and her children. The lords are all show. They want to look as powerful as the king, you see, want to do what the king does. But when it's time to be loud like a king, they all cunt up and let the king act on his own, and all tell him how wise and great he is. They line up right behind him, those brave lords, those courageous dukes, counts, and knights. And if it all goes wrong, well, they were just being loyal to their king, yeah? It's like a child walking around in his father's field boots. The cobbles in Ambrosius' courtyard were as red as the fake clay stones the masons had troweled up the walls. The place was fairly large, though. I saw a squat building made all of mud bricks along the back wall, which I assumed was where the beer was brewed. It was all beer and wine with the nobles, from childhood to death. But you mustn't get the wrong idea. When I returned to Colmar and had what the nobles drank for the first time, I discovered how awful it really is. It's all watered trash. It tastes of little more than dirty water. I mean, I get why they made it that way, obviously. If the stuff was too strong, they wouldn't get any work done. They wouldn't drink water, of course. That's for peasants. It's what made them sick half the time if they couldn't get beer, or for some reason could not brew their own. But then the brewery passed from view, and I had nothing to focus on but the main donjon as they marched us across the yard. The place was constructed from massive square beams as wide across as a plowman's shoulders. There were towers at each corner that climbed higher than the main structure, and I could see the shadows of archers moving around up there, looking down on the rest of us. I learned later that those towers are the highest structures in Goslar, higher even than the bell tower at Godin's temple. They made the rest of the building, which was just a plain box, appear somehow greater. There were two large doors set into the front of the building, black as tar and branded in iron. These stood wide open during the day to allow the servants and workers to hurry about unhindered. The guards marched us straight towards them, and they stood before us, huge, even for Risa, waiting like an open mouth. The shadow of the outer palisade fell across the donjon's wall, making it appear darker, and I could see the murky blobs moving along the edge of the shadow's line. When I looked back at the wall, I learned those blobs were more guards making their rounds among the parapets. Whether their attention was directed outside the keep or inside looking down at me, I cannot say. We plunged through the doors after only a glimpse. The activity inside was as busy as the activity without. People rushing everywhere, some of them armed, though most were not. Mostly they all just looked like people working hard. I saw men, women, and children alike bustling about, doing some task. They carried buckets of water or armloads of wood. One man walked right through the main entry with a whole line of trout strung over his shoulder, dripping all along the floor as he shambled and growled. I saw one lady carrying a basket of sweet rushes on her shoulder, and the damned thing looked as large as me. That woman was built like an ox, though, and twice as ugly as me, so the basket seemed not to give her much trouble. She was quite a woman. They took us through the entry hall, then up a staircase in the back. At the time, I was quite impressed with everything. Remember now, this was before I'd stepped inside Ing's place. Even the staircase, which looked to me like something huge and grand, but was truly just an old staircase made of wood. You could see the same thing in just about any town where the buildings climb higher than a single story. It sure looked impressive to me, though, when they marched us up the thing, and the guards behind us carrying their banners and fucking swords. We took a few turns, and were consequently turned around when we came to Ambrosius's audience chamber, a room of middling size. It was roughly half as large as a proper alehouse common room, with a large brick hearth in the back behind a long table. The long table had a few chairs behind it, and the chair in the center was very large. I figured it must have been Lord Asshole's chair, and the others were to be used by his secretaries or something. There was a guest book along the left wall, bound in leather, and as thick as my thigh, and all around on the walls were tapestries and paintings of many naked people. Those did not interest me very much. All the tits and cocks were undersized, as if I were looking at a hybrid race of adult children off frolicking together through the woods. They were all getting up to things they should not, looking like that, and I didn't wish to see. There was one painting that held my eye, hung up by a window on the east wall, and I stared at it for a while because there was not much else that was good to look at. It showed men and women sitting around in chairs. They were calm, and their eyes were closed, and they seemed surrounded by many shirtless men in white aprons. The shirtless men who stood around them were removing the heads of those calm people and replacing them with cabbages. There was a basket full of heads at the feet of one of the calm men, whose own was held removed from his neck by a good foot, and on the other side of the painting, yet another shirtless man swung a huge cleaver at the neck of another who calmly bowed his head and waited for the blow to come, while a woman, his wife, I assume, looked away in horror. There was a line of more people coming in at the back while those in the chairs were being murdered, and on the left side you could see a whole group of shirtless men in aprons choosing severed heads from a plate to throw into a large oven. They all looked so very calm, those people waiting to have their heads removed. They all looked as though a beheading was precisely what they wanted.
"I see you have found the bakers at Iglo," sang a voice from the back of the chamber.
"Is that what it is?" I muttered. I couldn't pull my eyes away. I didn't realize the guards were no longer close behind me. The speaker came to stand at my shoulder. I could tell it was so because I noticed Risa look around at him from the corner of my eye.
"It's a famous legend," said the voice.
He sounded as if he was about to launch into a well-practiced speech.
"Long ago, before people knew any better, there were many men and women who were unhappy with the faces the gods had given them. The rich, who were within means, would go to the bakery to correct this problem. For a rather hefty fee, the baker would lop off their heads, replacing them with cabbages to stem the bleeding, dress the heads in oils and fine spices, and put them into the ovens to finish properly baking. And then, when the newly baked heads were beautiful, they would be replaced on the people's necks. They could go off into the world now as attractive as they should have been when they were born."
"Cabbage, you say?"
"I do."
"That doesn't sound like it should work." There was a soft laugh then.
"No. Also, there was the little problem that sometimes the bakers would overcook the heads so that they would come out burnt or otherwise deformed. There was always that danger, you see. Always the chance that the bakers would leave you worse off than the gods."
"I don't like it," I said thoughtlessly. "They seem too happy to have their heads cut off. I remember scratching at my neck when I said that. There was some damned itch there that my fingers just couldn't reach."
"Between us, I dislike it as well. As a young man, I had a reaction very similar to yours. And I've been unable to see those people as anything more than hogs forever after."
I tried not to shiver when he said this, but I think I must have anyway.
"I have a long day, Yander. A very long day. Even so, I wanted to see to your affairs personally."
"I'm now speaking to the Lord, am I not?" I asked.
"You are."
I sighed. "Please forgive us. I hadn't realized—"
"Get up, Yander. You're required only to stand in my presence. You need only stand just over there in the center, you see."
I took Reese's hand and led him over while that son of a bitch stood by the painting, watching us with a smile. Then, us standing out there like a fucking island, I asked, "Here?"
"Yes, that will do."
He went to the long table at the head of the room, pulled out the largest chair, and sat. He made a big show of arranging his sleeves over the tabletop so that they laid just so, and then called,
"Niklaus!"
A wizened old tree root of a man shuffled in from the back. He wore thick robes, dyed a deep shade of purple, and a gray cap with chin tassels so long they hung down to his belt. He left them untied, and so the thing just kind of perched there on the crown of his head, and every time he turned, I found myself waiting for it to slip off, but it never did. He carried a slip of parchment in his hands. We stood there and watched as he walked slowly to the table, as he laid the parchment down upon it, as he muttered and bowed his way out again without sparing us so much as a glance.
"Thank you, Niklaus,"
Ambrosius called. I wanted to speak, but did not know if it was allowed. As we now stood in the center of the room, and as Ambrosius was now seated at his table, I was unsure if the proceedings had begun. I think I may have cleared my throat or something, because Ambrosius said,
"Yes, you have something to say, Yander?"
Please, forgive, Lord, but—
"My Lord."
"You're what?"
"You address me as my Lord. I assume you haven't had much opportunity to practice courtly manners, having devoted as much time as you have to anointing your animals with inappropriate names."
I winced. I'd been convinced we'd forgotten to pay some sort of fee to the city. Now standing in that hall, I cursed myself and wondered why I couldn't just name my fucking donkey normally. Fritz would have done just fine. "I apologize. My Lord, you are correct. We are rather mean folk, and this is all very new to us. My Lord."
"Very well, you are forgiven."
I think I nodded. I definitely let out the breath I'd been holding.
"Well?" he asked.
"Well, my Lord?"
"Well, I was waiting for you to say whatever it is you have to say before we begin."
"Of course. Again, my Lord, I apologize. I guess I was wondering, if anyone else would be, joining us, my Lord?"
"Joining us?"
Secretaries, advisors, perhaps. A few guards." He said nothing at first, until I threw in a hasty, "My Lord." Then he nodded.
"As I said, I prefer to deal with this matter personally. Also privately."
I lowered my head and waited. When he didn't immediately speak, I closed my eyes tightly and focused on controlling myself.
"It would seem, Master Yander, that you are rather fond of, shall we say, risky names for your livestock?" "Quite risky, I'd say. One such of these, I understand, has been named—" Damn, my memory fails. "Niklaus!" "Niklaus, what was the donkey's name again, do you recall?"
From someplace behind me, a weakly squeaking voice called,
"Ambrosius, my Lord."
"Ambrosius?"
He nodded slowly. His eyes were round and disbelieving.
"Fathom that, Yander."
"Yes."
"An amazing coincidence."
"Yes, my Lord."
"Is it also a coincidence that you stupidly trumpeted the animal's name all through my city?"
My lord, it was hardly through the whole—
"Do not correct me."
"Yes. My Lord, please forgive me. I didn't mean—"
"Shut your mouth, Yander."
"I did."
"Shut your mouth," he repeated. "Shut it. Shut that filthy hole before I task Sir Pritchard with the removal of your tongue, letter of mark or no."
I continued saying nothing.
"It said, unspoiled, Yander. But it is forever possible that we began our rightly ordained work upon your person before it arrived."
I still said nothing. In fact, I don't think you could have hauled a single word from my mouth with a fucking horse team. He watched me a while, nodded, and said,
"Named his ass after me. How do they say it where your kind festers, Yander? The term is sand, is it not? That's some sand, Yander. How about it? Huh? Nothing to say now? Well, my word, I wonder if it means you're learning." Excellent. I suppose this means I'll forego asking you any further questions, owing to this new skill you've discovered, you mewling fucking swine. Niklaus! What is the penalty for one who has so insulted his lord?
I wanted to tell him he was not technically my lord, that I'd come from Colmar. Only then I remembered I hadn't been to Colmar for years. Something about standing in the middle of that floor put me right back in that city again. In the meantime, Niklaus, the corpse wizard, was calling from the outer hall again.
Severance of the tongue, my lord!
Severance of the tongue, you say?
Ambrosius laughed happily.
Well, isn't this a coincidence? The very thing I would most dearly love to visit upon you. Would you not call this an auspicious circumstance, Yander? Yander? Speak now, you idiot.
I would call it so, Lord, my lord, if I knew what that word meant.
It describes a turning of profound good fortunes.
I felt a hand on my shoulder. I wanted to scream at first, but it was very large. It was warm and gentle, too, so I knew it would do me no harm. If you say it is so, then it must be, my lord. I glanced up to see where things were likely to go. His lips separated slowly when I did, from one corner of his mouth to the other, and what was left behind was the most hateful smile I've ever seen. There was a sickness in his smile, a kind of malice so deep I suspected it had no bottom. A man like that would do anything, I thought. Probably had done anything, either because he was happy, or sad, or mad. Or nothing. I imagined he had done terrible things on occasion because he felt nothing at all. Many terrible things are the method whereby those who are broken inside are able to feel something.
Niklaus?
My lord?
Fetch Sir Pritchard, please. Send him to us.
Then we all waited around for Sir Pritchard to arrive. I think he probably came pretty fast. He was breathing heavily when he stepped through the door. It felt to me like we waited forever, though. He strode into the chamber and bowed.
Sir Pritchard, thank you so much for joining us.
My lord.
Sir Pritchard, do you recognize the man standing here before you?
I do, my lord. My lads have been feeding them for the last few weeks, leastwise.
Are you aware of the accusation they face?
I am, my lord.
And what accusation do they face, Sir Pritchard, if you please?
Insult to the personage of the Lord Ambrosius von Unzu Goslar, perpetrated by one Yander the Crier in the form of having named...
Yes, yes, very well, Sir Pritchard, thank you. Thank you very much. And what, good knight, is the punishment for such affront?
Severance of the tongue, my lord. My guts were churning sourly, so I sighed. I thought of hot pincers plucking my tongue from my mouth and nearly blew the previous day's ration all over the floor.
Very well.
Ambrosius smiled.
But have there been deviations from this practice?
Deviations? I choked. There was a noise then just behind my head. It sounded like the hard rattle of metal plates. When I whirled to look, I saw that Sir Pritchard's hand was frozen mid-descent, only a few zoll from hitting the back of my skull. It was held in place by Reese's hand, which was locked around his wrist. I had to stare at this a few moments like an idiot before I realized what had happened. Then I looked at Pritchard, eyes wide, and breathed, "Please, he doesn't understand." Pritchard was looking at Risa with a very ugly expression.
"You will tell him not to do that again,"
Ambrosius said in a flat voice. I nodded and swallowed hard. I probably should have tried to say something, but something wouldn't come. I had only a little to offer, so I gave it all to Risa. "Risa," I whispered, "you mustn't do that. Here, give me this. Let him go, Risa." Risa. He let go, praise the High Nine. I don't know what would have happened if he had not. "Look at me, boy. Look right here. You have to let him, Risa, do you understand? You have to let him. If you don't, it'll only be worse. Do you see? Goddamn, boy, tell me you see."
"See."
I nodded. he would probably be okay. They would see he wasn't the one making all of the decisions. I hoped. I turned back to Pritchard. Really just a small, ugly man dressed in mail far too fine for his sake. Concentrated on keeping my hands at my sides, closed my eyes and said, "He won't interfere now. They say you see a flash when it comes. And sometimes I guess they're right. I don't remember seeing a flash, though. I don't remember much after it came. He won't interfere now. And then nothing. And then the next thing I remember is looking up at Risa. I was flat on the rug looking up, seeing the larger timbers running along the ceiling, supporting the ceiling, and my hands felt wrong, like I couldn't make them work. And Risa crouching over me. I think he was crying. "As I said, Yanda, you must stand in my presence." "I'm sorry, my lord. Please accept my apologies." They both helped me up, and Risa kept holding on to me when I swayed on my feet. Ambrosius was drumming his fingers along the tabletop. He said,
"I will again ask you not to interrupt me when I am speaking."
"Yes, my lord." He stared at me a moment longer, then,
"Sir Pritchard, you are going to note any deviations from the common practice?"
"Yes, my lord, there have been some."
"Why?"
"Apologies, my lord, because my lord decided it more fitting in certain cases to remove the appendage most used for the condemned's profession."
"Which was mostly hands, of course."
Ambrosius smiled. "Yes, my lord."
"But you can still find the odd errand boy hobbling around on a crutch, is it not so?"
"Yes. Yes, my lord." Ambrosius laughed and looked back at me.
"I give you Sir Pritchard. Would you like to know, Yander, how many peasant parts Pritchard has parted from peasants? I wonder if he's lost count by now. It seems a reasonable assumption, doesn't it, that he's lost count? Sir Pritchard, have you lost count of all the tongues, hands, and feet you've collected?"
"My lord," he muttered, but seemed unable to look up from the floor.
"Sir Pritchard is most modest," Ambrosius conceded. "I assure you, Yanda, he is the finest Scharfriester in all of Northern Teodiscus."
He waited silently after telling me of Pritchard's abilities. I don't know if he awaited my response or if he was savoring my discomfort. He was bound to be disappointed in case of the former. At that moment, I distrusted my ability to refrain from shitting my own trousers.
"Are you ready, Yanda?" "Are you ready for your sentence? Are you, little hog, prepared for my judgment?"
My lord.
"Ask me, Yanda. I want you to ask me to be your Rishta."
I tried to speak, but I could not. I had to push Risa away gently, and then I spoke anyway. It was very difficult to speak. I kept salivating, and I couldn't stop myself from doing so. My lord, I seem to be without choice. Ambrosius laughed.
"Yes! Yes, it's always wonderful, isn't it, when all the lies and deception are cut away and only the hog remains? You are quite right, Yanda. You have no choice. And now, choiceless, you shall await sentence."
He read the slip of parchment Niklaus had given over for some time while I shifted around on my feet. Then he sighed, sadly it seemed to me, and read,
"To the Lord Ambrosius, House Gosler, and Keeper of the etc., from His Royal Majesty Dithmar the Bold, King of Teodiscus, Sacred Protector of the Realm, etc., and many other titles besides." Just a minute, we must read beyond all the tiresome preamble. Ah, here we are. "We have been given to understand that our beloved cousin..." Oh my. And here he goes into all the names and titles again. Of course, this is all due to his scribe, propriety being what it is. Just a moment. Yes. "Has taken two men into custody, one of these being a giant of prodigious strength and potency. We have concluded these men are of the greatest importance to our efforts in Valhaz, and insofar as it is our holy right to press our concerns in the south, and whereas the presence of this giant can only be of tremendous moral and spiritual succor to the many men and women now encamped on those distant shores, it is our desire and command that these men should now be conveyed to our royal seat in Colmar at greatest possible speed, unspoiled. As always, we send our greatest love and and then it goes into all the names and titles again. I'm sure you get the general sense of this letter.
I guess I just stood there breathing, because a few seconds after, he said,
"Well?"
When I came to myself, I said, "Forgive, please, my lord. Did you just read that we're to be sent to Colmar?" Ambrosius tossed the parchment carelessly to the edge of the table and said,
"Congratulations, little hog. Your ears appear to function. Yes, we shall convey you and your pet simpleton to Colmar.
Oh, praise the...
Your crimes in Goslar still stand yonder. Return to my city ever again, and Sir Pritchard shall execute your sentence. Let this be a warning to you. I do not care to see your face in these halls again."
"Yes, my lord." I bowed. I almost thought I could taste the dust on the floor. I bowed so fucking low. I was still bent over when Ambrosius was halfway to the exit. My lord. He froze, but would not look at me. "I'm so sorry, my lord. Please forgive me for..."
"I suggest you make this very quick, my little hog."
"Of course, my lord Ambrosius, again, I am sorry. But my donkeys, my lord. May I ask that they are also convi..." I never finished the question. Ambrosius was laughing so hard you could hear it echoing all along the halls of his keep. If I had kept speaking, he never would have heard me. This persisted for a long time, Pritchard smiling his stupid confusion at me all the while. And when his laughter had trailed off to a few choked rasps, he finally said,
"Yeah, oh, yonder, you poor stupid fool. What do you think I've been feeding you?"
The echoes of his laughter continued to fade as he left the room. They echoed a long time. And I standing there in that fucking room, with my heart buried.